cash rules everything around me. Queen, get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo. Good afternoon, evening, morning, whenever you listen, everyone, and welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, episode 25 of the season, recording on July the 18th, a Tuesday. You'll hear this from Wednesday and beyond whenever you choose to listen. And I'm Vlad Sedler at RotoGut on Twitter. I'm joined by a very special guest, very special in many ways, but particularly because he is a very cherished colleague of mine. He's also one of, maybe the best dynasty prospect analyst in the business. It's one of the reasons why we wanted to get him here over at FTN. So he's a colleague of mine. He writes weekly columns, including Crossed Up, named after him. So you can probably already guess who this is, as well as our weekly pitcher rankings. He's a co-host of the Tool Shed podcast, along with Chris Clegg, and does various other things as well in the industry and other sites. And he's a former FSWA Baseball Writer of the Year 2021 and probably more in his future. And ladies and gentlemen, at Eric Cross 04, Eric Cross. What's going on, man?
What's going on, Vlad? Thanks for having me, bud.
Yeah, of course, of course. You and I have, we've known each other for quite a few years. We got to spend a little bit more time with one another at First Pitch Arizona this previous year. But I remember one specific time and one of the things that really stood out to me about you was, it was the pre-pandemic. It was probably like the 2018 First Pitch Arizona or 2019. I remember like there was a time when we would all go to games. It was just part of like what we did at FPAS. And I just remember you were like extra locked in, like more so than anyone else. Like people were like laughing, having a good time, drinking beers. And there you are like sitting right behind the pitchers, like full on analysis mode. You hear nothing around you whatsoever. You got your radar gun. And man, you were really working. You're like hard work. And I'm like, dude, that's exactly the type of person I want to have here at the, on the FTN team. So I just wanted to kind of point that out and it's something that I really personally respect about you.
I appreciate that, man. Yeah, the Fall League and FPAS are always a blast. Yeah, I think we met, I forget if my first year was 2018 or 2019. I actually can't remember at this point. The last, 5 years with most of it being COVID has been an absolute blur. But yeah, the Fall League is so fun where, obviously I go, it's fun as well. But yeah, just getting some, that's my avenue to getting looks at some certain prospects that I don't have a chance to see, in season. Because obviously they play in a league that doesn't come anywhere near me. So it's always fun to see like those prospects. Oh, I get to see, so-and-so that I couldn't during the season. So yeah, that's always a nice added bonus going out there.
And then how is it like with the other prospect people? Because that's really the only time I see them is in November or October, whenever we're there for First Pitch. And, obviously other guys that I know really well, like, Chris Blessing, James Anderson, Chris Clegg, obviously like all really good guys. And you guys, for the most part, get along, Jeff Pontes. But are there like kind of rogue dynasty people, like people that you guys, when you see each other, you got like the evil eyes going, or is it all like pretty friendly for the most part?
No, I mean, I think it's all pretty friendly. I've known Jeff Ponce for a while. He's probably one of the first people I ever met in this industry. And obviously he's up here in the Northeast as well. So we meet up at games usually a couple times a year. And, obviously, Chris Blessing, Chris Clay, James Anderson, Chris Welsh, a lot of Chris's in the Dynasty and Prospect.
Welsh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of Chris's. And yeah, it's always fun. I think that we're all pretty, we all, talk and, like, hey, what do you think of this guy? What do you think of this guy? So yeah, I think it's a nice little community in the little prospect world we got, the little niche corner of the fantasy baseball world, so to speak.
And my apologies. I know that, some people, like, it annoys me when people say Jared Kelenic when it, sounds like a call, Kelenic when it's Kelenic. So my apologies, Jeff Ponce, I know, is not Jeff Pontes. So my bad on the pronunciation there. A little bit on kind of your background and your story growing up. Like, where did you grow up? What was your favorite baseball team growing up? And just kind of how did you get into baseball stats and fantasy?
Yeah, so I born and raised in the state of Maine, never lived outside of Maine in my entire life. Probably never will. I love the state so much. I grew up in a small town. I'm a small town kid. I mean, I think the biggest city, which is Portland here in Maine, only has like 70,000, which is not that much in the grand scheme of things. You look at all the other states that have big cities, but yeah, small town kid, grew up in a town that had, 5 or 6,000 people. My graduating class was like 100, so it was small town. Loved it though. It's quiet. I like that. But, grew up in a town called Freeport, and I've lived just outside of it or surround it, since I moved out of Freeport, moved out of my parents' house after I graduated high school. And yeah, had the Portland Sea Dogs double A team for now Boston. But when I started growing there, they were still with the, at that time, the Florida Marlins. So it was always fun to, see the next big stars come up through. Like back then, like Hanley Ramirez coming up through. And then obviously some of the Red Sox guys like Dustin Pedroia and all of them. So it was just really fun to see, oh, these guys are going to be up there with, the Red Sox or the Marlins someday, and they could be the next MVP or Cy Young Award winner. So that just going to games at a young age with my parents, it's really kind of piqued my interest. I've loved baseball from a young age. I played T-ball when I was 3 years old, all the way up through high school ball, and just always loved the game. And then just being able to go to games at Double A, which is about 15 or so minutes from my house. So got to a lot of games when I was a kid. Obviously still go to a ton of games now. It's really kind of piqued my interest, and that just kept manifesting and growing to the point where, when I did get into the industry, 6-7 years ago now, that was always like, all right, I kind of want to do that at least partially. And luckily when I started with Fantrax, it was kind of a blank slate, so to speak, because they were just starting their content side and kind of could write about whatever you wanted. So that's why I kind of gravitated to that. And obviously still do it now. So it's just that young age going to minor league games really helped pique this interest for what I do now.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I guess I never really thought about it from that perspective. I mean, I think most people just kind of think of things from their point of view. But like, I grew up in Los Angeles. It's about, just about as big of a city as you can get, and not far from Dodger Stadium, and at the time it was the Fabulous Forum, now Staples Center, now like Crypto.com. I don't know what the hell it's called.
It keeps changing. I can't keep track of it anymore. It keeps changing every 3 years.
Yeah, it's like this, the bright lights big city. I'm used to it, and that's just, as you were telling me that, it really makes sense, like where that love resonates from. Like, it does sound. I mean, to me, it really feels like there's really something special. Like, first of all, I mean, not. Thinking about it as a kid, you always kind of, it's always, grass is always green on the other side, but like growing up somewhere in a small town where you can, it's just like so convenient to be able to go to these minor league games and watch budding stars, right? Like you mentioned, the Hanley Ramirez's, the Dustin Pedroia's, and it's like, you're almost like a prospect analyst in, it by blood before you even, really kind of realize it yourself. Right. And to be able to root for these guys and project and almost foresee them in major league uniform. So that's really cool. I never thought about that perspective, but like, that makes a lot of sense why you're kind of, the road that you've taken in fantasy.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I also just love like the family aspect of going to the minor leagues. Like I bring my kids when I can drag them out. Sometimes they don't want to go, kids don't want to do what their mom or dad tells them to do. That's a shocker. But I know they do enjoy going to games, especially my daughter. My son, he's 7. Hit or miss with him. My daughter, she started asking me questions about, hey, what just happened? Why did that player do that? What's happening now? So she's kind of morphed from going for all the extras they do, in the minor leagues, the mascot, all the games and all that, to actually like kind of learning the game. So it's been really cool. And the last game I went to this past week, it was just me, but right next to me was a father and son. Son had to be probably 8 or 9 years old. And then he was just asking a ton of questions, and the father was answering, like, telling him like, oh, this prospect's pretty good. This guy's going to be pretty good. So yeah, I love that element of it too. The family aspect, you go to kids, and yeah, it kind of brings back memories of when I was a kid.
And totally like uneducated big city guy question that might even be offensive, but like, do they have clam chowder at the games, or is that just like, is that silly?
No, they don't. It's not silly, but they, I think certain games or certain venues in New England, I think they probably do. But at Hadluck Field, where the Sea Dogs play, they don't. I don't know if I trust
lobster,
it.
No, yeah. Sandwiches.
The main, well, now they're the main Celtics, used to be the Red Claws, the G League team for the Boston Celtics, did have lobster rolls one season about 5 or 6 years ago, that I recall. But outside of that, really, no, it's just your generic hot dogs and pretzels and popcorn chicken and stuff like that. But I don't even know if I trust it, dude. I am, being from Maine, I can fully admit I'm a seafood snob. I won't even get like a, lobster roll from like a McDonald's or something like that. I'm like, no, I need to go to an actual like seafood restaurant out on the coast and get the real stuff. So yeah, I've grown up as a seafood snob. So I'm not even sure if I would trust it, to be honest with you.
Wait, did you say lobster roll McDonald's? I didn't even think about that. That's another thing that I guess, yeah, that would make sense that your McDonald's would have lobster roll.
Yeah, they do it some. It's not often. It's obviously very seasonal, and they don't even do it every year. But yeah, they do it some, at least up here in the Northeast. I'm sure probably not in the rest of the country where seafood's not as prevalent. But yeah, they do it sometimes up here. I had it once. It was all right, but it's not up to snuff with some of the other, you know, like the coastal restaurants, you know, like Mike's, you know, Fish Shack, you know, all the random little holes in the wall that are, you know, kind of the hidden gems of the coast of Maine. So, yeah, it's always fun, though.
Yeah, man, I just need to get out there one day. I need to get up to the Northeast and the East Coast, just a, you know, just like a totally different vibe. I think it'd be nice for me to get out of Los Angeles one of these days and show my kids like a different part of the world, right? Like we don't need to always be, you know, stepping on like, you know, glass and around, you know, druggies and homeless people. But, you know, that's the LA life, or at least, you know, a little certain part of it. On to happier things. Let's talk dynasty. Let's talk prospects and in relation to, you know, the season and how things are going. I know what you do with dynasty and with prospects. Like I see your work and not just what you do for us on the site, but just your work across the board and how active you are on Twitter. And you have quite, I mean, I have a lot of Twitter followers and you got way much more. Like you are like, it's amazing. How, like what a following you have and how many questions you answer all the time. So I can see it. It's a grind and you have, you know, young children, you have a day job, you've got, you know, lots of responsibilities, yet you're still answering all these questions. And for me, I respect it very much. And even more so because I feel that dynasty prospects, it's harder than regular fantasy baseball. It's just like another added element to it. There are just so many unknowns. The data is less accessible, less reliable. At least, you know, it was a few years ago. I feel like it's getting better now. And just like more assumptions that need to be made, higher margins for error. You're getting more, you know, crap from people. Like if you know, you're not like answering their question or answering their questions and just being wrong, right? And people are overblowing it based on like a 1 week sample or one start. It's like, oh my God, Bryce Miller, he's the greatest. Oh my God, Bryce Miller, he's horrible, right? So like, I guess first of all, how do you handle all that? Like with your time management, how are you able to stay so active and so helpful on Twitter and for Discord subs and you know, your Patreon and all that, those things, and yet still, you know, get everything done? Is time management a big part of it? Are you like, okay, in this next 2 hours, I got to do this. And then do you compartmentalize your days or your weeks?
So I think I can answer this in two simple responses. First off, I don't sleep much at all. I'm one of those like 4 hour a night people.
Wow.
One of those crazies. Like I probably go to bed on average, probably 2 a.m. is probably my average. I'm up at 6 a.m. That's when my alarm set to get my kids up, get them off to school or right now summer camp. So, yeah, I only sleep about four. Some nights I'll get 5 or 6. Other nights I only get 3. But I think that helps because if I had to get 8 hours a night, if I was one of the oversleepers, as I call them, compared to me at least, that put me to bed at 10 p.m. My son goes to bed around 8. My daughter 8:30 to 9. So, And I don't do any content till after. Sometimes I have to do, if I have like a deadline and I have to get done, I'll do a little bit while the kids are up, but I try as much as possible to do it after they've gone to bed, whether that's writing, podcasting, whatever. So that'll just leave me no time to get anything done. So luckily, you know, I've always been one of those 4 hour a night sleepers. So that helps a lot. So I can get, you know, 8 till 1 a.m. or whatever, get my articles done, like my, you know, Twitter, you know, do some more stuff on Twitter, update my rankings, whatever it may be. And then I just love it, man. Like it's a labor of love, but I'm so passionate, you know, about sports in general, but especially baseball, obviously. And, you know, that's why I've always loved, like I was doing, even before I, you know, broke into the industry, I was already doing this stuff just for fun, you know, just on my own time. Like I'd make my own rankings and I wasn't writing articles, so to speak, but I was kind of doing a lot of the stuff that I do now just for fun, just for my own personal, you know, my home leagues with my high school buddies. So I think just because I love it so much and, you know, it's fun. Like, hey, I can actually do something I love and, you know, get a little bit of income from it as well. That definitely always helps. And yeah, it's just loving what I do so much. It helps. Like, it doesn't feel like a, you know, like a second job, so to speak. Like, oh, I don't go clock in for this. I can kind of do it on my own time. And again, it's something I enjoy. So that, I think that really, really helps to, you know, get everything done that I need to get done.
That makes sense. And then are there times of the season, maybe like during the middle of the season, are there any times that you feel like ever burnt out like consistently at a certain part of the year, or do you keep things pretty cool where that doesn't really affect you? Like you're just grinding the whole season through.
I think, you know, around the All-Star break, I will admit there's usually like that, you know, couple days where I'm like, all right, it's nice to have just a little bit of a break here. And it's just like, you know, 48 hours or so. But then usually after the season ends, you like early October, I usually am like, take a slight step back, you know, take a breather. But you know, for the most part, I think I've found that nice blend of, like I tweeted out like a week or two ago, like it is possible to both grind and find that appropriate work-life balance. Because if you don't, you're going to get burnt out. Like I used to write these massive top 25 team-by-team prospect rankings articles with player blurbs in all 25 for Fantrax back in the day. And they'd be anywhere from 4,000 to 6,000 words every one. And I'd be up till 5 a.m. sometimes writing them. Like I'd be up so early or late writing them. Our editor, Doug Anderson, would already be up. He's an early riser, like editing other articles. I see him in the back end of the site, like editing other articles to get them ready to post. So that kind of dawned on me like, all right, I got to stop doing this. This is not healthy. So I think it took me several years, and it's a hard balance to find. But once you find it, you'll feel a lot better. So I think that once I found that definitely helped for a lot.
And then how have you sort of adjusted, I guess, as we grow older, I think, and become more just mature, and some of us become, you know, I guess more emotionally intelligent over the years, but like, how do you deal with negative feedback on Twitter? Like people trolling you, if you got something wrong, like, is this something that you've progressively gotten better at and kind of built thicker skin for? Do things still bother you? Because it's weird. Like, I feel like I have somewhat advanced over the years where like I was super sensitive and like everything would bother me. And then now at a certain point, I just don't care, you know, and I feel like there's some like ease that lets go of it. And like, you know, I feel like, you know, if you're wrong, you're wrong, right? Nobody expects someone to be perfect. Right. And then you know the difference between somebody questioning you respectfully versus just like a random troll that's, you know, picking you off for like just some stupid thing that, you know, they're just like not even worth responding to. So how do you deal with that? And then are you able to just like avoid certain types of trolling? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe, I mean, I don't really see it. So maybe you don't get any trolls whatsoever.
Oh no, there's definitely some out there for sure. You know, I think what honestly helped me is that, you know, I became a father, you know, fairly early. I was my oldest was born. I was about a month shy of turning 22. So I was a little bit on the younger side in terms of becoming a parent. So the time I got in the industry, she was about 5 years old or so. So I think that kind of helped me, you know, with that. And something I teach her and both my kids now as well is that you just, no matter how good you are at whatever it is, no matter how well you're liked, you can't please everyone. That's just obviously, especially these days, we know it, so these true. Days, especially with the height of social media and everyone's fighting about whether it's sports, politics, whatever, you can't please everybody, no matter how much that people like you. So yeah, I had to learn that at a pretty early age or early on in this writing career of mine here, that, you know, I'm always, I'll put myself out there and I believe in what I do, obviously. And I always have reasons where, you know, if I say something like, hey, this, you should sell this player, I have reasonings behind that. And I will explain those reasonings. If you don't agree with me, that's fine. But I always welcome, you know, I love having those interactions, even with people I might have a different mindset, a different opinion that I do on a certain player or topic. I very much welcome those, but obviously keep it civil. I've had people, obviously, not everyone does, like, The one that always sticks out to me that I actually was just talking about with a buddy of mine yesterday was Dakota Hudson for the St. Louis Cardinals. I ranked him very low one year in my Cardinals prospect rankings, and someone cussed me out and ended up blocking me and just like swearing me up and down, saying I was an idiot, that I didn't know what I was doing because he didn't like my ranking of Dakota Hudson. Out of all people, Dakota Hudson, really? And I gave my reasoning why. I think it was probably centered around his low strikeout rate for, you know, obviously for fantasy, that doesn't help. And, you know, I move on. You know, it's one of those things where I always welcome the discussion, but yeah, obviously keep it civil. People don't obviously do that all the time, though, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I've been on that Dakota Hudson train a little bit. I've never, you know, again, he's part of a profile. It's really difficult with those low strikeout pitchers that maybe sometimes they can help out your ratios a little bit, but like for the most part, and Marcus Stroman was one of those for several years where it was just a profile I would typically avoid, simply because when things did not go well, you would kind of get the double damage, right? You'd get low strikeouts anyways, and then kind of get the ratios bashed as well. So, yeah, I know what you're saying there, Dakota Hudson. Good call on that ranking. That was good on the low ranking. One more question here before we dive in. Actually, two more. One before we dive into the rookie class of starting pitchers. Recency bias, I think, is a big thing, and especially in the dynasty and prospect world. I think it's just, for me, it seems like it's really, I feel like I would struggle with this, having to not allowing what has just recently happened with a performance like a hitter running cold or a pitcher getting bombed to affect my, you know, updating, you know, rankings and changing rankings, especially with prospects. Like, for me, being a specifically a regular season fantasy football player with some knowledge of prospects, not to the level that you and a lot of your colleagues are in, like, I know the Eury Pérez's and Tanner Bibee's of the world, but I don't really fully know what to expect. And I think most people don't, but prospect analysts have a better idea. But like, recency bias, I think, is such a big thing. And I think it really affects, you know, how one, I guess, roundabout way, how are you able to sort of block recency bias, or like, I guess, what are there any actionable steps that you take to sort of avoid it? Like, you know, like Eury Pérez running hot, like he's obviously not going to be, I mean, he could be, hey, maybe he's going to be, you know, the next Gerrit Cole and be, you know, a top five starting pitcher for the next 7 years. Most likely not. There's going to be, you know, we saw that bump in the road in Atlanta or whatever, but like, how are those, you know, start with those pitchers affect how you rank and how you think about these things?
Yeah, this is always a difficult balance to make. And going with Eury Pérez there, you know, about, I think it was about 3-4 weeks ago, I put a string of polls out on Twitter, and I put him up against just one v one, up against every one of my top 10 pitchers in my dynasty rankings. The only two pitchers that beat him out were Spencer Strider and Shane McClanahan. He beat out Gerrit Cole. He beat out Corbin Burns, you know, Nola, you know, all of them. He beat Framber Valdez, Zach Gallen. He beat them all out. So according to Twitter, the general masses, he's the number three starter for fantasy after what, it was like 7 or 8 starts at the time. Especially in the prospect world, it gets even harder, you know, because there's a lot more variables when, you know, you factor in like a recent string of performance. Like, you know, in the majors, like, all right, oh, we got Coors Field, we got the Great American Ball, we have the, you know, the ballparks that are either, you know, hitter friendly, pitcher friendly. In the minor leagues, we have full leagues. Like the Pacific Coast League is just extremely hitter friendly, always has, always will be. Same thing with the California League. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you look at down in, even you down like into the low levels of the minors, rookie ball, like, you know, you look at someone that has like, oh, this guy has like 40 steals in 42 games. Well, the quality of catchers kind of stink down there. So, and pitchers, obviously pitchers are very raw. So, yeah, so it's really hard to, you know, fully ignore recency bias, but that's why, especially with prospect, I try to look at the profile, whether they're running hot, running cold, looking at the profile itself. Like, all right, let's dig in. Look at the metrics. All right, are they striking out too much, or, you know, are they still hitting for, you know, hard contact, stuff like that, and formulating my opinion and the kind of my projection moving forward for these players off of that, and not like, oh, hey, they're hitting, you know, they're only hitting 200 over the last month. Oh, maybe they stink. You know, maybe, mm-hmm. no, maybe there's a reason why. Like Kyle Manzardo right now, it's because his mother is, you know, basically on death's door from what we've heard. So, you know, people are like, oh, why is Kyle Manzardo not hitting well? Well, this, you know, big thing in his personal life, you know, there's always something that goes, that's why I always urge, like, you know, look at the profile and make your, you know, kind of block out performance to a degree. Obviously you've got to factor that in. Especially in this day and age where, you know, we have so much data at our fingertips that we have to make quicker decisions, quicker rankings updates, like prospect rankings. Specifically, used to always be like, all right, preseason, midseason, that's it. Now it's like, if you're not doing it monthly or at least every other month, mm-hmm. you're way behind the game if you're waiting 3-4 months to update. So, but yeah, so in a roundabout way, I try not to let it factor into my, you know, rankings or my decision-making process too much. But it does bleed in. But just trying to look at the full profile is how I try to go about it.
Got it. And then another question is the MLB draft, the recent one that obviously that we just had, is that like your like Super Bowl? Is that like a really, really big deal for you?
It is. You know, I wish it got more kind of run in the mainstream. Obviously, NBA draft is big. Obviously, NFL draft is huge. But yeah, it's awesome, especially for a someone that does rankings, for prospect rankings, because that's the time like, you get this whole new batch of players to
throw into your
rankings. Yeah, it's awesome good. Because, you know, obviously, especially this year, we've had so many big names go up and already graduate. You know, the LEs, you know, the Gunnar Henderson's, the Corbin Carroll's, like, so you lost a lot of that star power. Now we can throw all these like Dylan Cruz's and White Langford's and Paul Skeens into the mix. So yeah, the draft itself, and obviously, you know, Chris Clegg and I had the privilege of covering it for Bleacher Report on their app during the first round. That was a lot of fun. And yeah, just you know, seeing where these players land, because obviously, again, a guy like Chase Dolander, one of the top pitchers in the class, landed in Colorado. Well, you know, big drop down the rankings there. So it's fun to see where these guys land, if they get into great systems or not, if they land in the Dodgers or the Marlins or stuff like that. And then, yeah, it's adding them into your rankings. It's like, it's literally, I hate to use this, you know, cliche, it's like Christmas in July. It really is.
And you never see what you see in other sports where they players, draftees refuse to just, you know, join a club. I mean, at least not that I remember. Like, right. For me, I mean, this dates me, but the Eric Lindros in 1988 refused to get drafted by the Quebec Nordiques, who had the first pick. And so they made this like monster deal to send him, I think, to the Phillies. And yeah, that, I mean, and we've seen it in the NBA and NFL, like, just like, you know, I don't want to go to this team. So, I mean, I can understand being a pitcher and then like getting, you know, you're excited. You might get drafted by the Guardians, the Rays, or the Dodgers, the Astros, and you go to the Rockies. You're like, man, now I'm behind the eight ball.
Yeah. And it's the one I always go to, obviously the Eli Manning, Philip Rivers one, where they, you know, Eli mm-hmm. didn't want to play in San Diego. That's the one I go, because I was a kid going when that happened, or, you know, middle school or whatever I was. But yeah, especially with these the high school players, they have leverage where it's like, all right, I don't really like this. How this is going? I'll just go to college, because they're already mm-hmm. all these guys are already committed to know, Vanderbilt or Clemson or Wake Forest or Texas, wherever it is. Like, all right, you know, I'll just go to college and, you know, get back in the draft in a couple of years. That's kind of fun to see, especially like these high upside like high school bats or arms. Like, are they going to sign? If you see them start slipping down the draft board, like, all right, this is farther than they should have fallen. You're like, all right, they're probably going to school. You know, they didn't really have any situations they liked. Any team, they didn't gel with any one team. So, yeah, that is a fun little aspect of the draft for sure.
And you mentioned Eli Manning, and I understand it from a perspective back then. Like, the San Diego Chargers were, you know, pretty bad. But, like, I mean, I couldn't imagine not wanting to live and start your career in sunny San Diego, which to me, I think is, like, the best city.
Right. And I've never been to San Diego, but I want to. I mean, I had a buddy that lived out there for a handful of years when he went out there for work after college. And he said nothing, but he's back on the East Coast now, but nothing but nice things. He's like, dude, San Diego is awesome. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how much of that was Eli, how much of that was Archie. I don't know. But yeah, who doesn't want to go to San Diego? I mean,
dude, come visit us. You know, Scott Jenstad, Jeff Erickson, a bunch of other people. We live out here. We'll take you to a Dodger game. We'll stop by an Angels game, and we'll go to Padres game. It'll be fun.
Yeah, let's do it up. Triple header.
All right. rookies, starting pitchers. This has been the essentially the theme of the fantasy baseball season. It's impacted basically NFBC and just fantasy all around this season, because we've never seen such a major influx of starting pitchers that have made such a tremendous impact. Not all of them are guys that we expected to, or guys that we expected who did not, right? Like, you know, guys like Brandon Pfaadt, Gavin Stone, guys that I was particularly high on in the preseason, have not panned out. And again, this is yet. They still might. I think we've seen some flaws with both of them, but I think both of them just came right back and been firing off in the minors. So we'll see, maybe something comes of them next year. But I wanted to talk to you specifically because many of our listeners are NFBC players, and just about how the innings pitched for a lot of these rookies and how many pitches, you know, innings pitched they have remaining is going to impact our decisions on whether to hold these guys rest of the season or drop them. And then also in terms of how some of these teams might handle the starting pitchers that are getting close to their sort of innings limit. So, you know, for example, you know, thinking back to Grayson Rodriguez. So for me, though, I loved Grayson Rodriguez and thought he was going to be a phenomenal pitcher and fantasy asset at some point, I did not draft him in NFBC. I basically, at his price point where he was going like 180 overall, I just could not quantify the fact that a guy that was going to essentially max out at 125, 135 innings, I could not draft him there comparing to other players in his range. And it's all like a market price game for me. It's actually one of the reasons why I couldn't get in on Dustin May, no matter how talented I was, because he also had a very similar cap. And granted, he's not a prospect. But, you know, we heard before the season that Grayson would be like a 120 to 130 innings pitched guy. And then obviously Yuri Perez, similar story. He had, you know, 70, you know, almost 80 innings last year. He's a little over that at this point, 84. But let's start with those two guys. First of all, like, I guess in the case of Grayson Rodriguez, like he was at 76 last season. He's currently at 92 this year. I think he spent a little time on IL, then he stunk in the majors, got demoted to the minors, started balling out again. Now he's come back. He made that most recent start on Monday against the Dodgers. How does a team like Baltimore that's in the playoff hunt, you know, wild card hunt at the very least, how do they handle him rest of the season? Like through September and the playoffs, if they want to be able to, you know, keep him, they need him part of the rotation. If he's doing really well, do they have some sort of threshold? Like, you know, or is it just like a case by case thing? Like, could they take him to 150 if they need to get him there? Like, how would you handle it if you were the Orioles, and how do you think the Orioles will handle him?
Yeah, it definitely is a case by case thing. You know, obviously every organization operates differently. You know, from what I've generally seen though, and again, it's not concrete by any means, is I kind of look at what they look at the innings pitch total they went with last year. Like, this is the baseline I go with, and times that by like 150-ish%. So you look at, you mentioned Grayson Rodriguez last year was at 75 2/3. Times that by two, quick math, we're looking at another 38, so like 125-ish innings. So that's about 34, 35 innings away. And obviously, they definitely push past that because obviously Baltimore is, you know, I think, contending and in a spot that they did think they might be in for another year or two. So, and they need arms for sure. That's like the one area that they kind of lack in right now is that high-end pitching. So they're probably going to push him a little bit past that, and they could do that by, you know, skipping a start here and there over the remaining, you know, 2 months of the season, and maybe push him back a couple of days, you know, go 6 or 7 days in between outings, or maybe they just do it, you know, the other way, which I kind of like more, is that, you know, drop him down. Maybe they only go like, you know, have a few starts that they go like 3 innings, you know? Yeah. Does it kind of tax the bullpen a little bit? Sure. But I prefer that way just from a developmental standpoint, because instead of just shutting them down, it's like, all right, they're not pitching for into August, September, these deeper seasons. This other way, they still are. You know, maybe they're only going three innings, but hey, you're giving them the experience of still making, you know, 33 starts or whatever in the season. So that's the kind of way I love to see teams do it. You know, obviously, some teams do that, other teams don't. You know, with Yuri Perez, you know, Craig Mish, you know, obviously was very, he's a beat writer for the Miami Marlins, very in tune. Basically, everything he says, it turns out to be true. He was kind of saying, yeah, they're going to, you know, innings limit here. It's going to be some sort. They're probably going to send him back down to the minors at some point. And this one, he was balling out, right? Like, he was just dominating. Everyone's like, oh, no, Craig, you're crazy. They're not going to do that. And sure enough, they send him to AAA. So, yeah, obviously, then every team is different in how they handle that. But, that's why I kind of don't go as in on rookie pitchers as I do on rookie hitters, because you don't really, there's not like an at-bat cap, you know, or a plate appearance cap on hitters. They just usually let them go for the most part. They're like, oh, we're going to stretch you down. You're 200 at-bats over what you were last year. You just don't see that on the hitting side. So that's why, you know, I don't avoid rookie pitchers. But if I'm going to go all in and, you know, start spending big, you know, big fab bucks on a big rookie, I'm going to do that more so on the hitting side than the pitching side.
And then, so Yuri Perez is a specifically interesting case. And one of the great things is that you mentioned Craig Mish, who's also a fantasy player and very in tune with the Marlins, as you said, great guy. And one of the few beat writers who is fantasy friendly. So it's really helpful to, we kind of get a little bit more you know, flesh on the bone, so to speak, with when it comes to the Marlins. And he's obviously very helpful in that regard. But we, I mean, how are NFBC players going to have to treat Eury Pérez? Because I think, at least for me, a lot of things I just sort of use common sense. So, like, we don't know what's going to happen with Eury Pérez, especially as kind of past his innings limit right now. I'm at his limit, but he's past what he pitched last season. And then we've heard GM Kim Ng sort of allude to the possibility that it might just get shut down, or just he may not be a part of the Marlins the rest of the season. But common sense intuitively is, if you have Eury Pérez pretty much in any format, except for maybe like 18 in eight teamer, if those things, you know, still exist, you're holding on to him until you hear further, you know, word. Or unless you're, it's a really shallow league and you're just like so loaded where it's like you got to drop him, or like Jose Berrios, or I don't know, for example. Those are a lot tougher decisions. But for the most part, you just got to wait. You got to kind of hold off and see what happens. And if for whatever reason he gets shut down at that point, you drop him and you know it's done, so long as this isn't a dynasty or a keeper league. But how do you think Eury is going to be handled, especially if, say, Miami continues to win games, say Philadelphia slows down in that division, and it looks like Miami can legitimately grab it a wild card spot? They're obviously not going to win that division, the NL East. But like, how do you think what do you think is the fate of Eury Pérez rest of season?
Yeah, there's been a lot of mixed signal. Like you mentioned, you know, Kim Ng saying that he might not be up much at all. You know, when Craig Mish was initially reporting that, you know, he was going to get sent down in the near future before it happened, I think he was kind of floating around like the 120 to 130 range, which would give Eury about another 30 to 35 innings potentially. So, and again, kind of like similar to what I said with Baltimore, I don't think Miami thought they'd be in this position when the season started, when they're kind of formulating their game plan for Eury. Like, all right, we'll start him on at this level. You know, if he pitches well, we'll get him this many innings. I don't think they factored in that there would be right now in a wild card spot. You know, obviously they're 10 games behind the Braves, but they are right in this massive glob for the wild card with Philly, San Fran, Arizona, and they are currently in one of those spots right now. So, and, you know, then they have a good pitching staff. It's not like they can't get by without him, but, you know, obviously they got Sandy and then Lizardo and all them, but he is one of their impact arms. So it's hard to say. I do think he comes back up, and unless they just absolutely go on, you know, a skid and lose, you know, like 12 of their next 14 or something like that, and kind of fall like four or five games out of a wild card spot, then I could see them being more kind of gingerly with their because obviously Eury Pérez is gonna, you know, they predict him to be like a frontline arm for them, and got this, they're gonna build around for the future, and they don't want to risk that by, you know, trying to squeak out a wild card in year one of his career. But for NFBCers, yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with what you said, Vlad, that unless you like, you're desperate, like completely desperate for that spot, you need the whatever you need right now. You need production right now. You got to hold them. Even if it's like, you know, your 6-7 team bench formats, you know, for the upside that he brings, like he was a top 10 fantasy arm for like 6 weeks. You know, for that type of upside, I'm willing to, you know, burn one of my bench spots for that. And again, until, like you mentioned, you hear more concrete, like, all right, he has X many more innings, or hey, we're gonna shut him down, we're gonna do a few more starts in AAA and then shut him down. Until you get that concrete info, which I'm assuming we probably will hear within the next couple of weeks, if I had to venture a guess, you got to hold on to him for now, just given the upside and how good he's already been at the major league level.
Yeah, and just thinking about how, I mean, He was one of the most, I guess, even for non-prospect folks, like people knew, you know, if you're a fantasy player, you kind of knew who Eury Pérez was. You knew he'd be good, but you thought maybe, oh, he'd come up, maybe make a, you know, a start or two. Miami isn't really competitive. He'll get sent back down. He's only 20, right? Who would have thought he would have come up, dominated at that level, be better than his like mentor, so to speak, Sandy Alcantara, who was the literal Cy Young the previous year, and you just like, you know, dominate him. It's quite impressive. So I think I've heard this on some other podcasts, and I think I'm kind of on the same page as far as like where he might go next season in NFBC drafts. But he looks like a legit third, fourth rounder. And hey, maybe that might be an overpay, but like I think 40 to 65 overall range, I think is probably what may end up being a fair price. So long as, you know, we think the innings will be okay.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was going with this. Like, I kind of feel that too. But man, if he does come back up, gets 25, 30 more innings and keeps doing what he already did, man, I don't think like top, you know, 30, I could envision a future where he sneaks into the back end of the second in a 15 teamer. Mm-hmm. I can envision that. You know, I think more so third or fourth round, kind of like SP, you know, 8 to 10 range. But it would not surprise me if we fast forward to next March and we're getting done draft season and, you know, he's SP5 in drafts or something like that behind, you know, the, you know, Striders mm-hmm. and McClanahan's and those guys. So, and Garrett Cole. So yeah, I could see him right in that range and maybe even higher. Like everyone gets sucked into the big rookies that performed going into their second year. Like Bobby Witt Jr., recent example of that. I'm sure, you know, Corbin Carroll's probably gonna be a top 5 pick at this point. Eli De La Cruz, well, I mean, we'll see. It's a little bit of a slump right now, but obviously he's one of the most exciting players in baseball, so we can see him as like a top 20 pick overall next year. Yeah, definitely the high upside rookies that have shown, you know, good performance already, everyone eats those up. So, yeah, I could see Yuri even as a back-end second rounder.
And so I have these guys segmented in basically three sections. I should have probably mentioned it at the top, but – so this first group, which includes Grayson and Yuri Perez, are pitchers that have already surpassed last year's innings. The next group of guys will be guys that are like kind of on track. They're going to surpass it soon. And then the third group are guys that are way behind. They're probably the safest group. But the last guy in our first group, along with Yuri Perez and Grayson Rodriguez, is Brian Wu. And this guy's, you know, I mean, I'm not going to go for the easy pun here for how much he's wooed us, but man, this kid has been impressive, and he's on one of my very competitive teams that's competing in an overall. And I would love for him to just kind of finish off strong. But I don't really. I mean, I'm looking at. I look back to last season. I think even in the show notes, I have his innings from last year off. But like, so he hadn't even pitched in Double A going into the season. He, you know, he was at High A, was the highest level last season. But was he hurt last year? The fact that he only pitched around, you know, under 60 innings in 2022. Are there some innings missing from some other league?
I don't recall honestly if there was an injury last year or not, but yeah, Brian Wu, I mean, he's absolutely been impressive. He has the highest K minus walk rate of any rookie arm, even higher than Yuri Perez. And if you drop the innings threshold down to, where is he at? 34 and 2. They're like, you jumped into 30 innings. I think he was like fifth or sixth at all of baseball, and came right up there, obviously, with the studs. And you look at his Savant page, it's absolutely beautiful. And this is not fluky whatsoever. His xERA is even lower than his surface ERA by nearly a full run. It's down at 2.78. So, yeah, anybody that got Brian Wu, because you remember back when it was probably like what, May, maybe even bled into a little bit into June, when we had like one week after a week after a week where we had that big name pitcher come up. It was like, you know, Bobby Miller and Bybee and all them, where we were going triple digit fab bids on them. Mm-hmm. Wu like didn't command that much. I don't remember what he was going for. Maybe you recall that off the top of your head, Vlad, but I don't think it was like triple digits.
No. And so, I'm wondering, did we see the first start beforehand? Is that maybe what happened? Cause he pitched he got bludgeoned in Texas. It was his only bad start. And I'm trying to remember
I think that's 100% what happened. So that absolutely helped. I actually prefer that because anybody that kind of passed him over because a rookie pitcher making his debut against a top three offense in Texas with, you know, basically a murderer's, you know, modern day murderer's row of hitters. Okay, yeah, he sucked in that start. Who cares? You know, so if that said, drop down the bid and, you know, drop it, cut it in half or whatever. Yeah, so that's why I got a couple of shares of Wu. That's one of the rookie arms that I actually did get, you know, multiple shares of this season when he came up, because the price was so low and he was balling out in the minor leagues, and we're seeing a lot more of those Double A to majors promotions now than we ever saw. So that's not really overly surprising anymore. And yeah, he's been, you know, one of the, you know, best kind of waiver wire gems of the season so far, and hopefully he keeps going. But and obviously Seattle is in the postseason hunt as well. So yeah, Wu has been great. I love Wu.
So much of it is a market price game, right? And it's psychological. So he does get blasted in that first start, but he obviously is, you know, is a The only risk there was like, okay, might he get sent down if he does get hit up again? And the issue at that time was, I believe they lost Marco Gonzalez and they had previously lost Robbie Ray, and they really needed arms. So there was a little bit of leash there with Brian Wu. And I mean, I got him for single digits in 12 team OCs.
Was it that low? NBC. Yeah.
It was like a couple weeks later, but and sometimes people are slow there to jump on pitchers there, but you mentioned a good point earlier and something I wanted to bring up with him as well. When you look at a lot of these rookie pitchers who have been phenomenal, all even Bybee, Yuri Perez, like all of them, their indicators, their xFIP, their xARA, their Sierras are all higher than their actual ERAs. And really the only two guys, I mean, Wu's the exact opposite. Like, so he's, as you mentioned, like a 3.63 ERA, but his Sierra, his xFIP, it's all like low threes. And then the xERA is 2.78. And in the case of Taj Bradley, the same thing. He's been quite unlucky. And you look at his some other stuff like his BABIP and strand rate. So yeah, interesting point there. But do you know anything about innings limitations with him, or we can just hopefully ride him out rest of the season?
I mean, I haven't heard anything or seen anything personally. But right now, so what's he at between the majors and minors this year? He's currently at about 70. Yeah, right in the upper 70s. He had 44 in AA, 34 and 2/3 in 3/4 and with Seattle. So, and last year, yeah, he was at 57 overall. So, with him, like he's always been an advanced arm. Obviously, he was a four-year collegiate guy at Cal Poly. So I can see them going above that 150% kind of mark that I kind of use as my base mark. So I can see him getting another 30, 40, maybe even 50 more innings. Like, I don't really see him getting shut down. Again, you mentioned they kind of needed arms this year with some of the injuries they've had. So I think we're safe. I never know with these guys. It's hard to say, but he does feel like one that it doesn't feel like imminent that we're going to, all of a sudden lose him to, skipping a couple starts here and there, or even the Yuri Perez method and sending him to Triple A. I don't have that feel with Brian Wu.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then this next group of guys, I'm just rounding here, so I'm not just to kind of keep it easier, but the two Cleveland guys, Tanner Bibee, he was at 133 last year combined in the minors. He's at 91 so far. So kind of on track. I mean, that's, I think, 40, 60 innings, he's pretty much good. I think good to go for the rest of the year. Same with Gavin Williams. Well, he was at 115, a little lower than Bybee last year. I believe he had an injury, right, to going into this season. And that's kind of why they started him off at Double A. Is that correct?
I can't remember what it was. It was like a minor thing, but yeah, he did miss a little bit of time.
And then a third guy we'll round out for this group is, this guy's been a surprise because I've been like off the since the beginning of the year, and it's been fruitful for me, is I've been anti Reds pitchers going into draft season. Like, no matter how amazing, how many strikeouts these Hunter Greens and Nick Lodolos are going to get, I just didn't want any piece of that ballpark in the summer. And obviously these guys are hurt, so we don't know how things could have gone, but Andrew freaking Abbott, man, like, this guy's insane. So he was at 118 innings last year. He's at 102 so far this year combined. But these major league innings have been phenomenal. I think really only just one poor start otherwise. Have things changed for you as far as like your thoughts on him? Do you like him more now from what you've seen? Is something he can maintain? Can he be like a top, eight round guy in NFBC leagues?
I think he absolutely could. Because the one thing with Abbott is obviously, and what we chase a lot of times with pitchers in fantasy, he's always been a guy that's just been ridiculous strikeout rates. Like, I think his K rate was like 55% through his first like six starts in the minor leagues this year. He was just like, every start, I was like, all right, 12Ks, 13Ks, 14Ks, 12Ks. And that's always been his MO. Like, he's always been a guy that gets a lot of swing and miss. Is he going to be a guy that's going to post stellar? Is he a 2.45 ERA guy moving forward? Probably not. And it's going to be kind of hard to do so in that ballpark, being as hitter friendly as it is. Even I think he actually has a better ERA at home right now than on the road, oddly enough. But yes, that'll probably correct itself going forward. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the fact that he misses bats so consistently is going to be a huge plus. He's got above average whiff rates, above average chase rates right now. And, the K rate is sitting at 27%, which is actually probably a little bit low for what he's capable of. So as long as he continues to limit the walks as well as he is, and he can keep the ball in the ballpark, which is always the issue in Great American, I think he's going to be fine. And I think he could be, you know, he kind of reminds me of, I usually suck with comparisons, but kind of like Robbie Ray, where it's like, all right, the ratios might be a little higher. Maybe he's like an upper threes ERA guy. Maybe the whip's a tad higher, but you take that with just all the strikeouts that you get. So, yeah, I think he could definitely be. So top eight, we're talking, you know, a top 120 pick and 15 teamers. Yeah, I could absolutely see, especially if he keeps this going and finishes the season strong and still has like a low three ERA end of the year and 28% K rate or something like that. I can see him pushing top 100 ADP next year for sure.
And then, I mean, I believe most people had Gavin Williams and Tanner Bibee pretty close to one another, but I believe Gavin Williams is, you know, slightly more attractive prospect, but he came by a little bit after Bibee. But Bibee was my big buy-in, and it wasn't by design. I wasn't necessarily – it was just one of these things where I pushed up my bids on Sundays at the last minute. I really, you know, was hurting from pitching at that point. I recall when he was called up, I was getting – Flaherty'd and Kopech'd and Matz'd to death, and my ratios were floundering, and I just really decided, okay, at some point I'm gonna have to go in, this will be my guy. And he's been a savior, like every time he goes out there. And I know the ballpark helps, and you know, he's a good arm and a good prospect, but like, man, outside of like maybe, you know, a walk rate that isn't all that great, it's nearly 9%, and the strikeouts aren't, you know, amazing, but he's been really solid this year. And I know, you know, maybe Gavin Williams might be a little bit more of an attractive of a prospect, and I'm sure he'll be great as well. But I mean, this is nice, right? Both of these guys have both bright futures, I believe.
Absolutely. Just the Cleveland pitching factory working its magic once again. And yet these guys like the Tanner Bibees, who, you know, they did have, you know, he did have some decent prospect kind of stock, but he was never really like the big buzzy, like Gavin Williams was, the big buzzy prospect name that was getting all the hype. And oftentimes these guys always fly under the radar and are guys that you can get for, you know, cheaper than probably what they should be. Like something me and Chris talk about all the time is like the perceived value of these guys. That draws everything. You know, doesn't matter what they're actually doing. It's what everyone thinks they're capable of or not capable of. And that draws their creates their perceived value. And with him, it's because he wasn't flashy. He wasn't the, you know, the big buzzy prospect name like Gavin Williams was. He's a guy that always kind of did his thing and flew under the radar while the other big names are garnering the attention. But look at what he did last year. Like, this has always been a high floor arm. Like, he only had 27 walks last year and 25 starts, 132 and two thirds. A guy that, you know, going back to the innings discussion we've been having here, 132 innings. Like, there's really no worry about him getting shut down anytime soon. I mean, in AAA, he had 15 and a third. So he's up to 91 in the third right now. He's still 41 innings below what he did last year. So, I mean, unless, you know, Cleveland has some other idea, just because they're leading the Central right now, aren't they? Is Cleveland leading the Central? Oh, no, they're a game and a half out, even though they have a losing record because that division is terrible. Yep. But, yeah, Cleveland is contending. So, yeah, I don't see any reason for them to shut him down unless they have some other grand scheme that they're sticking to. But yeah, he's one where he pitched so many innings last year. I think we're good to go with him.
And there's a little bit of similarity in terms of the mirrored over in with the Dodgers, who I'm obviously pretty familiar with, but Bobby Miller and Gavin Stone. So I've been on the and you know me, I'm big on stats and everything, and I sound like a rookie right now, but you know that I kind of just go with my instinct on certain things, especially when I, you know, when the eye test tells me so. And I've been on the Bobby Miller is going to be a superstar bandwagon for quite some time. So in, you know, during draft champion season, those 50 rounders, I was making sure that I got Bobby Miller everywhere. And it's like, okay, if he doesn't make it up this year, or when he got, I think, hurt in preseason, obviously that was concerning, delayed his season. But I'm like, I need to get this guy. And when I'm talking about the mirroring is it's similar with Gavin Williams and Tanner Bibee, because Gavin Williams was the flashy first rounder, and Tanner Bibee was the kind of more, I don't want to say more solid, but kind of more boring fifth rounder. It's the same thing here. Bobby Miller is a Dodgers first round pick. Gavin Stone is a fifth rounder. But there was a lot of debate, I remember, during draft champion season in the preseason because of how good Gavin Stone was last year. And when I mean good, I mean 100 innings between double and triple A last year with an ERA around 1.5. With a strikeout rate around 35%, you know, walked a lot of guys, but still, it was quite impressive. And this is, you know, obviously a guy that does not throw 100 miles per hour, you know, with ease like Mr. Bobby Miller does. But I mean, right? I mean, there are little similarities between these guys, even though they're a little different.
I mean, yeah, the arsenals are definitely different, but yeah, Gavin Stone, absolutely. It was always Bobby Miller, and then Gavin Stone really came on last year. I guess he was maybe the best pitcher in the minors last year. You just listed the stats. He was phenomenal, and that was, you saw the gap between he and Miller in prospect rankings really shrink, and even I saw Stone go ahead of Miller. I don't think I ever went Stone above Miller, but they were almost back to back entering the season. But you know, I saw Bobby Miller live last year out in, I think it was last year. It's hard to remember at this point. But yeah, last year, I think it was last year out in the AFL when we were out there for FPAS, and he was running a few innings, but you could just see the stuff. And he's just popping 99 on the gun consistently, that wipeout slider, decent changeup as well. So he's always the one where I'm like, all right, if I'm going to invest, well, I was, you know, I liked Stone and did get some shares of Stone both in redraft and dynasty. I was like, all right, if I'm going to go in on one of these two, I'm going to go more in on Miller, because I think the gap between the two, like the upside gap, was bigger than the floor gap. You know, I think Stone could be considered a little safer, sure, but at the same time, you know, I think that gap was much smaller than the upside gap, where, you know, Miller has like frontline, you know, frontline rotation stuff. Stone, yeah, he could be a good number three, maybe a back end two, but didn't really have the looks and have the stuff for, to, you know, lead a rotation like Miller could. And I saw Miller earlier this year in Philly. I was at the Phillies game. He scored off against Aaron Nola and outpitched him. He was just popping 100 on the gun, like even in the fifth inning. So yeah, Miller, he's the one. It's easy to say this now because Stone hasn't really panned out well in the major league level, but I still have faith in him being at least a decent enough fantasy arm. But yeah, Miller, you know, even if the stuff isn't there in anyone's start, even if the overall stats might not blow you away, like the stuff is absolutely there for him to be an impact arm, you know, a top 25 pitcher moving forward. So he's the one I'd rather hitch my wagon to, so to speak.
By the way, guess who's been scooping up $1 Gavin Stone shares in 15 teamers? That would be smart. This guy. Just because you never know, right? I mean, you've got Clayton Kershaw. Obviously, the news is good and looks like, you know, good bullpen session. He'll be back. But I mean, for example, I don't know how Michael Grove is doing as we're recording, but you know, if things don't go well for him, or if Bobby Miller, who had a setback in his last start, doesn't. I mean, at some point, Gavin Stone might be back. My only thing is, I can't figure out. So he came up for like right before the All-Star break for, you know, pitched like an inning or two in, you know, for the Dodgers, and I believe went back down. But I keep going back to his box scores to see, you know, how he's doing in the minors. He still hasn't pitched since July 9th. At least that's what I'm seeing. And same thing, I'm looking at Twitter. But it was basically his best start of the season between the minors and majors. You know, 8 strikeouts, 6 innings, scoreless. But I haven't seen him pitch since. I don't know anything you know about that.
I don't. I know sometimes they, like, some teams like just give their top arms just, you know, a few extra days of rest coming out of the All-Star break, so maybe that's what it is. I haven't heard anything otherwise. I'm trying to see if he's going tonight here. Let's see. Is he going tonight? Oh, he is going tonight.
Okay.
Give up 4 runs, 5 innings, 6 hits, 1 walk, 5 Ks, and a home run allowed. So,
okay.
So there you go. He did go tonight. So, but yeah, he looked really good in his last start. And yeah, you got to imagine he's up at some point again. Like, I don't think we've seen the last of Gavin Stone. So, yeah, right now, if you you know, afford to, you know, use a bench spot on him, I think it's a good time to, you know, like you said, Vlad, scooping him up for a buck or two is pretty beneficial right now.
One last guy I'll touch on before we move on is the aforementioned Taj Bradley, who was another big, you know, prospect arm, 22 years old, great system, you know, tall, lanky dude, throws some heat, and man, that guy has been in some pretty bad luck this season. Just kind of looking at a BABIP near 350, a strand rate around 65%, giving up home runs at a higher clip than he's ever had in the minors, I guess by a little bit. And then just like the ratios, right? Like, you know, he's got a 5.5 ERA. His xFIP is a full 2 runs lower, which is, you know, obviously quite a big differential there. So he's had some bad luck and hasn't gone, you know, 5 innings a lot of times, but how has anything that you've seen from Taj Bradley changed for your opinion with him?
You know, honestly, my opinion hasn't really changed on Taj Bradley. I've always been pretty high. I've had him as a top 10 pitching prospect for, you know, a year and a half now. And I really don't think that's changed a whole lot. I mean, yeah, The one issue with him, he's missing a lot of bats and keeping the walk rate in check. Like, I think he's actually second on that rookie K minus walk rate list I mentioned earlier, behind Brian Wu. He's right now at 22.6%, 29.7% K, 7.1% walk. So, above average in both of those. He's just getting hit too hard. So that's the thing with him. Like, this is why there's a difference between command and control. When we talk about these young players, is that, he has good control. I mean, 7.1% walk rate is better than league average by about, 1 to 1.5%. But he's leaving his fastball and his four seamer and his cutter over the heart of the plate too much. And, they've given up 10 home runs combined on those. But he's still missing bats at the high clip, obviously. He's got, three pitches above a 25% whiff rate, with the changeup leading the way at 41.4. So, he's still doing a lot of things. And, for what it's worth, some of the similar pitchers to him, take it for what it's, it's kind of fun to look at. It's just really fun. But the similar pitchers based on velocity and movement on Savant, three names are Verlander, Dylan Cease, and Garrett Cole. Like, the stuff is there. And that's what I'll bank on the stuff. And the fact that he's not walking too many, that's also positive. He's got to really change kind of where he's locating these pitches, especially the four seam and the cutter. But if he can do that, and that's an easy, not an easy tweak, but that's a tweak that can be made, especially in a great player development organization like the Tampa Bay Rays, that, maybe the rest of this year might be more of the same, inconsistency, higher ERA than he probably should. But long-term, this is still like a really good arm, potential, top 25, top 30 fantasy arm that we're taking, within the first, five, six rounds of drafts someday. So yeah, still very much in on Tosh Bradley.
Yeah. And I think the good luck weighs in a little bit more remainder of the season. So I feel like anywhere that he might be dropped, I would be interested in scooping him up.
Yep.
And I mean, 13 starts that he's made this season, only once has he actually reached the six inning, has pitched six innings. And then of those 13 starts, I mean, almost half of them, he's got at least seven strikeouts in. He already has a double digit, K game. And that was in 4.1 innings. So 11 strikeouts and 4 1/3. Of course, that's against the A's. We saw what Nick Pivetta did to them the other day. But nevertheless, I like this kid a lot. Maybe if he continues to struggle the rest of the season, you might be able to get a good discount on him next year. So, yeah, like that you're on board with him. Real quick question before we get to our final section here. Just, in terms of these rookies, both on the hitter and on the pitcher side, but I guess more so on with the pitchers as we look forward to next season with draft champions, the 50-round DCs, and how much do you think the success of the rookie pitcher, a lot of these rookie pitchers off the bat, will affect how drafters will be looking at them for next season? And basically, does it have to do with class? Like, this has been such a hot class that's why it was kind of an anomaly? Or is this sort of a new trend going forward with us being able to trust rookie starting pitchers a bit more?
I think this is becoming a new trend. Something about 5-6 years ago, I think a lot of us were, especially me, were going, we're in on drafting rookies and the high upside guys because we're the what if factor. And then I think that kind of cooled over the last handful of years, especially for me. Like, I was not rookie adverse, but kind of rookie hesitant, so to speak, where I wouldn't really go unless I was like just absolutely like head over heels for that prospect. I this year with Corbin Carroll, I was like, I'm taking him in the 60s. I don't care. This is something that's going to happen. So, but outside of him, like, that was an anomaly. I wasn't really very much into the drafting, even though I write about them a lot, drafting prospects and redraft, just because obviously the hit rate on them is so much lower, especially for pitchers, more so than hitters. So, but I do think that we're seeing, with how much more aggressive, so kind of two things here, how much more aggressive teams are with promoting these guys. Obviously, there's more, rewards to calling these guys up, not as much kind of, limitations, and then how much success we're seeing out of these guys right off the bat, how, the Bybees and the Williams and the Bradleys and all these guys have impact, and Yuri Perez, like how they've impacted our fantasy teams. So I think those two in unison are going to, you're going to start seeing that trend start to kind of reverse itself next year. I got a good feeling about that. And we'll start being a little, not like crazy, more aggressive on these guys. But I think you'll start to see that kind of start ticking back up next year.
All right. That sounds good. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then obviously a lot of us will be a lot, very much in tune. I feel like more so NFBC players are paying attention, more and more to the work that Dynasty and Keeper League folks like yourself provide, because it really does give a competitive advantage, and we're starting to see that more and more. Let's end things with a little fun questions, just awards predictions. These are a couple of questions I've asked in previous weeks, but obviously things change week to week. Starting with a couple of rookies here in the American League. So last I looked at the Vegas odds, it's pretty much a dead heat between Josh Jung and Masataka Yoshida. Both guys are right around similar odds for AL MVP. If you had to pick one, who would it be? I'm sorry, AL Rookie of the Year.
That is, I mean, yeah, there's a reason why they're a dead heat, because they really are. I gotta lean Josh Jung on this one. I think he's really coming on strong, and Yoshida's been very consistent. As a Red Sox fan, I've watched obviously a lot of his games, and he's come as advertised. I think everything we hoped he was going to be, he's been. But I think Jung is really starting to come on as the season goes on, and the numbers are a little, sexier, quote unquote. So I do think, unless one of them really takes off or goes into a slump, I think it's going to remain close the rest of the season here. But if I had to give my vote now, I'd probably go with Josh Jung.
Yeah, it's a close one. It's a tight one. I did in our preseason preview thing, or awards predictions thing, I did select Yoshida, so I'm going to have to stick to that one. And I did not bet on it, but maybe I should have. But we'll see. That one should go down to the wire. AL Cy Young, another close one here. Gerrit Cole, a couple of good performances recently. Obviously didn't whiff 13 batters like Valdez did, but pretty close. I think 11 in his last outing. These two are kind of neck and neck, Gerrit Cole and Framber Valdez. You do have Kevin Gausman. He did have the setback. I think that kind of throws him back in the AL Cy Young race. And then Shane McClanahan, he was cruising until that final inning in his last start. But either way, I mean, he's obviously, I know you love him. He's one of the best pitchers in baseball.
Yep.
But he's falling behind in that race. Right now it's looking at like Cole or Valdez. You think that keeps up? Who do you think wins the AL Cy Young?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting race. Like, I think you could even throw Eovaldi into that mix as well. He's been like really good for the Texas Rangers too. I think he is a little bit behind these guys, but I mean, obviously the bigger, sexier name is Gerrit Cole. So I think he's probably like, by a hair, the leader in the clubhouse right now. But Framber Valdez is just so freaking consistent. It's insane. And the fact that he's now becoming more of a strikeout arm than he ever used to be too. So, I mean, right now it's almost a dead heat. Cole's got two more wins, and obviously I don't care about that, but I know the voters do. Almost the same amount of innings, strikeout rate is almost the same. Walk rate, Valdez is a little bit better, but I feel a little safer. We know Cole can have is more prone to that blow up here and there than Valdez is. So if that happens in September, it might leave a bad, a sour taste in the voters' mouth. So I feel a little bit safer about Valdez, so I'll lean that way.
Okay. Yeah, that's a tough one for me. I think I'm kind of 50-50. So NL Cy Young is another close one here. It looks like the momentum is definitely shifting towards Spencer Strider. At least that's who I, last week when we had a couple of great guests on, that's who I mentioned I thought was going to win it. Zach Gallen is close. He's, he slipped in his last start, but you never know. Usually after a bad start, he comes back and strikes out 11 guys with no home run. So Clayton Kershaw getting hurt kind of falls back a little bit. Blake Snell with his insanity is got to be in the mix here soon. If something happens to Strider, I think now is a good time. You just continue to, if you're a betting person, get in some more on Snell, because you never know what can happen here. And then Logan Webb, man, quietly just, one of my sort of boring guys in drafts. I remember even highlighting him, talking about how, I'm just not really interested in, didn't like the run support possibilities from San Francisco, who I thought wasn't going to be as good of a offense this year. I really had no idea Logan Webb was going to go back to 2 years ago, playoff Logan Webb, Jesse Plemons, he's been amazing.
Yeah, no, he absolutely has. Kind of just Mr. Consistent out there for the Giants. This was one I struggle with, because part of me wants to go Strider. Obviously he's leading the National League in strikeouts by 37. That's a pretty substantial gap from one to two, but he's had a little bit of a rough patch here. So his ERA is up to 3.66, but he is also tied for the National League lead in wins along with Zach Gallen, who's low 3 ERA and fifth in strikeouts. Pretty much it's the same thing for Webb, low 3 ERA, third in strikeouts. Snell has been absolutely dominant, but he only has 6 wins, which again matters with the voters. Oh, this is so hard. I will lean Strider here. I know it's kind of the the boring chalk pick. But
that's
part
fine.
Of me. Part of me does want to take Snell because, you know, he's always been a second half guy. And the fact that he started his second half dominance a little earlier this year than usual, pretty damn good. And I think he's given up one earned run or less in like eight of his last nine starts or something ridiculous. So he's coming on strong. But I do think I think I will go with Strider.
Yep, I'm with you there as well. Ronald Acuna, I just looked at the box score here. It's like 13-12, Atlanta, Arizona.
I saw that too. I was like, yeah, a lot of runs in that game.
Yeah, and I think seven of those runs came from Austin Riley, you know, better late than never. But Acuna, he stole his 44th base today, 43% of the season to go. He's got 44 stolen bases now and 23 home runs. Where does he end up both of those?
The fact that 40-80 is actually like within the realm of possibility is just crazy to think about. And it's the great thing with Acuna too. It's like, obviously we've seen it. He's already been the huge power speed guy. We've already seen that. But this year, like, what kind of goes under the radar, at least a little bit, is he has just improved exponentially across the board, you know, in terms of contact rate, you know, cutting the whiff rate, cutting the K rate, increasing the walk rate. So like really every aspect of hitting, he is just matured in spades. So, you know, everyone looks at the huge power speed pace, and, you know, obviously why not? You know, I do too, but he's hitting over 300. I think he's got nearly as many walks as strikeouts. It's insane, just the improvements he's made. So yeah, I'm gonna just throw it just for fun, so we can look back at this in a couple of months. I'll say he finishes 36-75, which is still like,
dude,
when's the last time there was like even a 30-70 year? We gotta look. Did Ricky? I don't think Ricky ever did it. Like,
There was an Eric Davis season that was pretty epic.
But we're talking about Reds. What 30-40 years ago at this point. So
yeah,
the fact that and who's to say he doesn't do it again next year? I mean, obviously with the stolen bases being more prevalent now, with all the restrictions on pitchers, who's to say he doesn't go back to back 70 steal years, something like that? It's fun to think about.
Yeah, Eric Davis in 1986, it was his first full season, actually, 27 home runs and 80 stolen bases. The next year, 1987, Eric Davis, 37 homers, 50 stolen bases, 120 runs, 100 RBI. So, yeah, pretty impressive. This is going to be like the best fantasy season ever. A couple of real quick ones here. You don't have to go into too depth here, but rest of season, who performs better, Julio Rodriguez or Corbin Carroll?
I think Corbin Carroll. I am just as long as the shoulder's the one thing I'm a little bit worried about, and I'm kind of surprised I didn't rest him through the All-Star break, given that, you know, that little thing happened with him like three games before. But the fact that he's just firing on all cylinders, doing everything we hope for, and then some. The fact that he's running a ton, he'd be Acuna if Acuna wasn't doing Acuna things right now. So I will go. You know, J-Rod's been good. You know, slightly underwhelming compared to, obviously, we were drafting him as a top five guy. So maybe there's, you know, he's underwhelmed a little bit compared to his draft price, but obviously still a very good player, very generational talent. But I will lean Corbin Carroll here. I think this is more category juice potentially the rest of the season.
Yeah, Carroll's definitely getting more of the hype. And there's, I mean, for what people paid for, and especially some people that actually, you know, there are people out there that took Julio Rodriguez over Ronald Acuna, and they're cursing themselves. And so the fact that, if you look at his number, I mean, everything, like, I mean, I think he's got over 20 stolen bases already. Like, you know, he's going to hit probably 30 homers, but it's just, you know, the average is kind of hurting a little bit, and I mean, he'll be fine. I think he can heat up like kind of like we saw last season. So I think it'll be really close. I think they'll obviously be easily first round picks. Totally different profiles here, but like both have been huge bums fantasy wise and real life. Byron Buxton is actually hitting under 200 now. He's got the same, I tweeted about this yesterday, he's got the same numbers as Joey Gallo and like 80 more plate appearances. Like, it's insane. Like down to the walks and strikeouts and average, like everything. He's basically putting a Gallo. But him or Tim Anderson, who do you think has the better season rest of the year? Sorry to do this to you.
Yeah, dude, why? Why are you going to make me do this? I mean, I have never, ever, ever been a Buxton. I mean, I love watching him play. He's one of the most exciting players in baseball, and I appreciate a center fielder that can just go get it. Obviously, not playing much in the field this year, but I will say him just because Anderson just looks absolutely lost right now. I don't know where that steady Tim Anderson went and where know, where this current version of him hid him, but he just looks absolutely lost. And, you know, even though I literally never have any shares of Buxton, you know, I think everyone thought, oh, if he can just stay healthy, look what he can do. I mean, the red flags were more than just the injury history. So I'm not surprised he's hitting, you know, as low as he is for average, but I will go Buxton just because I literally have no faith at all in Tim Anderson right now until he can show me. When the last time he hit a home run, like 4 years ago at this point, it feels like. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it was like mid-July last year. I think he's over a full calendar year now since his last home run. Obviously, injuries played in with him as well. But, yeah, I guess I'll go Buxton, but I don't want either, to be honest with you.
I mean, I alluded to this in my Fab article. Like, if Tim Anderson, like, most likely he's going to get traded. And, obviously, the Dodgers need a shortstop. So, it'll be very interesting if he somehow magically starts hitting. Like, did he really give up on his team? Can professional players really do that? I know he's has I think some diva tendencies, but like, yeah, I mean, it's possible.
I mean, and even though obviously they got a guy in that I think was well respected within an organization, and obviously the Ralusa experiment last year did not pan out well at all. So maybe that's kind of bled over into this year. Obviously, they're an underperforming team once again with all that talent they have. So yeah, maybe it's just one of those situations where a change of scenery kind of jump starts his season. So, you know, leading up to the deadline, obviously the White Sox are not, you know, doing anything this year. So yeah, if he gets dealt, it definitely would, I would be interested in seeing if that's kind of like what gives him a little kick in the pants.
All right. One more here, or a couple more. Let's do Yuri Perez and Grayson Rodriguez aside. If you were to pick one starting pitching rookie from this class, who do you think would be like a top 30 NFBC pick? Starting pitcher in 2 years, so not 2024, but in 2025. If you had to pick one guy, one horse that you could count on in the next couple of years,
so we're talking just guys that have debuted this year.
Yes, so just your, you know, the guys we talked about earlier today.
I think the one I like the most out of all the other non G-Rod and Yuri Perez names, I think it's gonna be Gavin Williams. So he has everything you look for in like a frontline guy. Like, he's got the workhorse frame. He's got to toss a ton of innings, big fastball, misses bats, Cleveland added plus there. So, you know, I love me some Miller. I love Taj Bradley, but I think I would give the slight edge to Gavin Williams.
Yeah. I'm not going to not be a homer and not go with Bobby Miller. I'm going to go with Taj Bradley, but I bet him and Gavin Williams are my top three. So Bradley, Bobby Miller, Gavin Williams. I like that. I don't know if you agree with me. I think the Braves are going to win the World Series. That's kind of what I thought all year. Are you with me on that, or do you think someone else does? And then if not, I mean, who do you foresee as the two teams in the World Series this year?
I mean, it's hard not to go with the Braves right now. I mean, I think they are the most complete team in baseball. You know, they obviously great pitching, you know, a good bullpen, obviously, you know, the best hitting team in baseball with studs up and down the lineup. Like, when you're you can kind of disagree out there if you think Orlando Arcia should be the starting shortstop in the All-Star game this year, but the starting shortstop for the All-Star team was hitting like seventh or eighth for them. That's just how deep that lineup is. So I think they're, you know, with how Tampa Bay's, obviously they won't face them until the World Series, but, you know, the Mets have been a massive disappointment. The Dodgers are always there. You know, San Fran's getting hot now. So, but I think there's no team is on that level. Every other team, even the Rays, I think are a kind of a peg below in terms of just the overall talent on that team. So it's hard not to say Atlanta, but man, wouldn't a, like, you know, I think the general masses would hate this, but the baseball purists would love like a Baltimore Cincinnati World Series, like two of these fun young teams that are just bringing up all this young talent. That would be really fun. I watch any World Series, but that would be a lot of fun. But I think I wouldn't put that out of run possibility. I mean, both are, Baltimore's in a wild card spot right now. Cincinnati is just out of it, but they're only two and a half games behind Milwaukee in the Central. So, you know, they're getting Green and Lodolo back in August probably. And then maybe if they go, same with Baltimore, if these two teams go and trade for like a Bieber or someone like that, and, you know, they still have a lot of prospects and young talent they can give up. I mean, don't sleep on those two teams. Like, I wouldn't be surprised at all to see them in the World Series. You know, I really wouldn't.
So that leads into my final question of the podcast. Is there like a Cinderella type team that is under the radar? And it doesn't have to be, you know, a young hot team like the Reds that I feel like has been that kind of team the last 2 weeks, but a team that makes some deals. our buyers, excels in September and just makes some moves and like maybe surprises a you know, pulls an upset in the first round of the playoffs or something like that. Could it be like your Red Sox perhaps or the Blue Jays? Like, who do you think that team could be this year?
It's funny you mentioned my Red Sox. I wasn't trying to be a homer here, but like the first two teams that kind of popped in my head were the Red Sox and the Arizona Diamondbacks as well. If they can get some pitching to go, we'll go with Gallen and Merrill Kelly there. But yeah, I think the Red Sox are sneakily becoming that kind of that team because expectations, especially here in Boston, I mean, and I still don't like Chaim Bloom too much, but you know, this team has done, you know, pretty well. They've exceeded my expectations this year. Obviously, the pitching staff is kind of in shambles right now. I mean, you got Bernardino opening for Pivetta. I don't think anyone thought that was going to be a scenario in nearly August. But if Sale can come back healthy, if, you know, they can get something out of Tanner Houck, if Brian Bayo continues to pitch well.
Trevor Story's coming back.
If they go out and, you know, they get a pretty good farm system. If they go and use that talent to go out and, you know, ideally get an arm or a bullpen arm or another bat, something like that. I could see Boston. I mean, obviously the AL East is an absolute, you know, juggernaut, and it's going to be hard to get into the, they're still out of the playoffs right now. Are they in the, no, yeah, we're still 2.5 behind Toronto for that last wild card spot, but it wouldn't surprise me if Boston kept going, and we'll see what they do at the deadline, see what Bloom does. Maybe he can redeem himself with us Red Sox fans a little bit, but yeah, I think Boston's making a push right now.
That was fun, man. It was good. It was also a nice change of pace, I think, for me and for the listeners as well. We're always just so NFBC heavy in this podcast, and also fantastic opportunity to bring you here as a guest. And, you know, obviously, man, dude, come on anytime. And I'm very, very happy to have you part of the FTN team and love the work that you produce. So, you know, thank you very much for everything and for informing our guests on some prospect stuff. Any final thoughts?
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. This was an absolute blast. I love to come back on whenever you'll have me. And yeah, thanks for bringing me on FTN. I mean, FTN is just, you know, so, and I saw this even before you and I started talking about this possibility, you know, back last fall and into an FPAS. Like, I just saw like what FTN was becoming and the growth that it already had over the last couple of years since it started. And I was like, yeah, this is definitely a site that I want to kind of hitch myself to and be a part of and help grow it into the future. So great things, even outside of our baseball world, obviously football and bets and data and it's everything. This site is just a beast in the making here. And it's been really fun to be a part of the team. And I think we have a great, especially in baseball, I think we have a great team. So it's been fun, man. It's been a blast.
Yeah. Hopefully we all get you there to the finish line to help you win your leagues and win some money. So make sure you follow, although I'm sure you already do, but if you don't, on Twitter he is EricCross04, and for Eric Cross, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.